Welcome back, you lovable lichens. It's Ding Dong Darkness time, and I'm Allison Dixon. We're in the thick of spooky season, Ding Dong Christmas, if you will. And with that, I have delivered you gifts in the form of episodes on vampires with Josh Bermont, zombies with Brett Talley, as well as a rousing discussion about horror writing and cinema with author Ed Kurtz. And we're feeling the irresistible pull of lore once again, one that awakens our primal energies and makes hair sprout from our knuckles and elsewhere as we run with the moonlight, tearing vulnerable things to shreds, all the moral protests from our prefrontal cortexes drowned by our guttural howls and the sounds of ripping flesh and the screams of terrified villagers. That's right, we're talking werewolves, my friends. And joining me for that discussion is Jason Blair. He's the host of the wonderfully insightful podcast, The Silver Linings Handbook, where he conducts fascinating interviews with a wide array of people and actually let me on for a recent episode, which was pure enjoyment. He's also worked as a reporter, a life coach, a mental health expert, and can also be found lending his wealth of knowledge and compassion to people in the true crime community and elsewhere, making all who know him feel welcome and like a lifelong friend. So now it's my turn to do the same for him. Hello, Jason. It's great to have you over here in the Ding Dong Dugout.
Aww. I want you to give my eulogy, could you?
Oh, absolutely.
That is so kind. It really is really kind. You know, you said in your introduction that I let you on. I am so grateful that you came on. Let me tell you, you know, it's funny because we were talking about, you know, our fascination with darkness, just people's fascination with darkness, because I'm always so curious about that. And I found you unbelievably insightful on the topic. But one of the things that really struck me about the episode was that it was so bright. It was so full of light and it was so optimistic. Like, I got one note and I got a lot of notes, of notes from women, interestingly. And this is one that sort of fits the theme, right? And this is what a woman who wrote me about it. Thank you for that wonderful episode. I've been overwhelmed and stressed a lot. I felt very alone. You know, I look forward to your podcast every week and I listened to Allison's episode already and it was awesome. I love how she can find positive life lessons in anything, even horror.
Aww.
And that is the tenor of what I heard in terms of feedback. And it was pretty awesome to get those messages and hear that. So.
Well, it means a lot to me to hear that as well, because I like to think of myself as an optimistic person at heart, even though you might have to kind of peel back the layers, or, you know, it's like an everlasting gobstop of cynicism, because I'm a Gen X kid. But, you know, deep inside, there is that nougaty center of optimism and hope.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that a lot of us that gravitate to sort of the dark side are fascinated by it because, you know, we may embrace the light and we want to understand what's going on there. So to me, it makes complete sense that two of my friends, you and Brett Talley from the Prosecutor's Pods, are totally into horror, and you're two of the most optimistic kind people I know. So,
you know, I turned to him to recalibrate my optimism meter a little bit, you know, like, am I getting a little too jaded? And maybe he does the same with me. I don't know. He's great no matter what and just always provides a lift to my mood. So, but I wanted to ask you, because in the previous episodes of this month's Spookfest here, I asked our guests a question to sort of get the discussion flowing. On the vampire episode, I asked Josh if he's ever consumed blood. In the episode on zombies, I asked Brett if he would line up for some Steve Stew. So now I have to ask you, Jason, possibly one of the most divisive questions of all time. Dog person or cat person?
Oh, that's a really tough one. But I've had dogs. I've loved dogs. But I truly am a cat person. I have two tuxedo cats that are in this room right now.
Aww.
Interestingly named Hannibal and Elizabeth, and they're totally sweethearts, and one's obviously named after Hannibal Lecter.
Nice.
Hannibal Lecter Blair, and one is named, no one ever gets this, Elizabeth Bathory.
I was going to guess that. I am not lying.
I knew you would. Oh, of course you would.
I loved my dog when we had him, and we sometimes think about getting another dog, and I love the bond of the human-dog experience. There's a keen sort of awareness and understanding emotionally that a dog has about a person, but it's a lot of work.
It is a ton of work.
I wanted to bring that up because a lot of what we're talking about today will be about the origins of the bond between human and canine and the way that the werewolf mythology sort of formed around that and diverged from that and why it's such a universal monster, so to speak, as it seems like we're talking a lot about the Universal Studios monsters this month with the zombies and the vampires and now the werewolf. But again, similar to last week when I talked to Brett about zombie lore and how deep that goes, I found myself absolutely fascinated by the same depth that this folklore carries with it, with werewolves and shapeshifters in general. So we're going to talk a lot about the history of the werewolf, which is ancient. And then we will talk about sort of our own personal experience with the pop culture, the literature, the movies, the books, all of that surrounding it, and sort of try to derive hopefully a little bit of understanding about ourselves yet again through one of our shared monsters. And so my next question for you, Jason, is what was your first werewolf experience in terms of movies?
Oh, that's a really, really, really good question, because I think a lot of my early werewolf experiences came from, in terms of movies, can we go with television?
Of course, yeah.
For your television. So really my first like werewolf shape-shifting experiences in television or film were actually the television show X-Files.
Oh,
do you remember the monster episodes that they used to have on X-Files?
Yeah, like, my favorite ones.
Yeah, because some people were like the conspiracy people and some people were the monster people. I was like both, but I really did love the monster episode. So that was sort of like my first sort of like visual sort of like engagement with werewolves. But, you know, over time, I went back and I watched a lot of, you know, even old ones like The Wolfman from 1941.
Mm. Yes.
And, you know, I don't know if you ever saw Teen Wolf, which was like this Michael J. Fox.
That was my first active, like full memory episode or movie of a werewolf was Teen Wolf. 80s kids.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I actually got that on DVD when they finally came out on DVD.
Nice.
So it was way back when. And you know, I've just been a fan of the concept because in part I've always thought, like, for me, and if, you know, I have my favorites, which I can definitely tell you, which may be somewhat slightly shocking to some people. Actually, they won't be shocking at all. But that whole concept of sort of like shapeshifters, you mm-hmm. know, in general, who change because of some kind of like, either on purpose or because of some kind of curse or affliction.
Yes.
You know, I always thought that like it is a metaphor for metamorphosis mm-hmm. and transformation. And, you know, in our society, there's such a fear of change mm-hmm. and there's so many fears. There's fears of our animalistic natures, but there are also these powers that we wish we had to protect ourselves and others. And that's to me why so many of the shape-shifting characters, particularly the ones that transform into animals, are so fascinating.
Yes.
Because, yeah, they really speak to something about us that we both fear and need, if that makes sense.
I love that you said that, and I love that you mentioned the duality and the way that we wish we had certain powers. I feel like there is always a little bit of wish fulfillment with all of these creatures of lore that we talk about. I'm fascinated by the lore of the werewolf and the way that it has permeated throughout indigenous cultures throughout this world since, you know, the beginning of human history. And humans seem to have sort of evolved with the canine. There was always a sort of relationship between wolves and humans, and such that, you know, the dogs we have today at home have evolved from those wolves.
You know, that's a really good point, because I think part of what it's both sort of like, and you mentioned duality. I think it's part of the both positive side and the negative side of things that shapeshift into animals is that, yeah, there's a part of us, like, and this sort of ties into one of my favorites, which have you ever seen the Halloween movie Trick or Treat?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Just so watched that recently.
Okay. All right. Perfect. So, Trick or Treat in the movie, they're like 8 different stories and they do a great job of weaving them together. But one is about this principal who's a serial killer, and he's stalking one of the women in the movie. And, you're fearful for her the entire time. He finally gets her into an alley, as I recall it. And, you know, he bites down on her or bites on her. So then it cuts to one of the other stories. And then all of a sudden you see this body in her cloak being thrown into the middle of the space with a bunch of other women. And in your head, you're like, she's dead.
Yeah.
Well, you actually find out it's him in her cloak. She's a werewolf. He was actually being hunted by her. And I think there's this, and I think this is a more recent take on werewolves, because you see it in shows like Netflix's show The Order, where werewolves are the good guys, which historically they haven't been.
Right.
Anything that's transformed into an animal hasn't been. Mm-hmm. But I think it's so empowering that the hunter is actually being hunted. And if you haven't seen Trick or Treat, it's great because all the good guys win it.
Love it.
But that idea of there being a power that allows us to protect ourselves from sort of predators and things that can harm us, I think is one of the most powerful parts of shifting creatures in general. And the other side of it, right, is that I think there's a fear of our own animalistic nature that plays into this. And I think you can kind of drop it into like a couple different buckets. You have shapeshifters that show up in religion, culture, folklore, and literature going way back to the beginning of time. Like the Norse god Odin could transform into... basically, he could will himself into almost any being. And even Jesus, when he took his disciples to the mountain and his face transformed and other things like that. But more recently, you've got characters like the Hulk and the Spider-Man. You know, Bruce Banner turns into the Hulk. You know, and you have these other places like that. But if you roll back into Native American and First Nation culture in the United States and Canada, if you look at the Algonquin family of languages, they have the Wendigo. Are you familiar with the Wendigo?
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's this evil spirit, right, that lives in the forests on the east coast of Canada and the U.S. And they're like depicted like these human-like characters. They supposedly have this malevolent spirit. Well, they, you know, or they still live there. I don't know for sure. I haven't fully checked it out. But, you know, they can possess other humans. And one of the curses there is you then, once you're possessed, you get this insatiable hunger and drive that leads you to cannibalize other humans.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's a great metaphor for that idea of our fear of our animalistic nature. But the one other thing I was going to say about it is, with that example, again, not turning into an animal, it's a relative good guy, even though it's turning us into cannibals, because the job of the Wendigo is to protect the forest. But when you start to get to the ones like Dracula, who can turn into a bat, a wolf, I think one of the things you get is they tend to be much more negative characters. And I think a lot of that comes down to our fear of our animalistic nature, the thin line between humans and animals.
I find it fascinating, too, that there is a clear historical juxtaposition between werewolves, cannibalism, and witchcraft. And we'll get to that in a bit as we sort of kind of meander our way throughout the history and kind of bringing in things from the present. But what I find interesting too is whereas many of our monsters like the vampire and the zombie, you know, they seem to offer an opportunity for people to express their anxieties around, you know, things like death or social structures, the changing of civilization. The werewolf and other sort of human animal shapeshifters offers a chance to examine that relationship with nature and wild animals. And wolves and human beings, as I said before, have a relationship going back thousands of years. And sometimes they are friends and sometimes they are adversaries. And wolves and humans also share a lot of the same characteristics. They travel in packs, like we often tend to do. They have families, like we often tend to have. We are a predator species, like the wolf. We eat a lot of the same things. You know, not always, but often. And anybody, again, who has a dog can absolutely attest to the fact that if a dog, if you're eating something in front of a dog, they will watch you intently in the hopes that you will drop a tasty morsel for them because they want to eat what we're eating. And that is very much part of that sort of bond going back millennia. But that ancient bond, that desire for these two intelligent creatures to understand and emulate one another, all but guaranteed that they would appear in some of the earliest folklore. And that's one reason I wanted to ask if you were a dog or a cat person, because as much as we humans tend to love and revere cats, we tend to place them sort of above us. They're almost like little gods, as the Egyptians revered them, ancient Egypt. And I just think that's really interesting, too, that you brought up the types of werewolves, the cursed werewolf, because history and folklore sort of do divide werewolves into three types. We have the victim, which is someone innocent who's been turned into a werewolf against their will, and they remain completely cognizant of the experience at the same time. The oldest piece of known literature by humans, the Epic of Gilgamesh, contains a story of a victim werewolf who is a shepherd who is turned into a wolf by a goddess. And then there's the cursed werewolf, and that's bad people, quote unquote, forced to become wolves as punishment, and where they must remain in that form until they fulfilled some sort of quest or purpose. And that features most prominently in Greek and Roman literature. And what's interesting about that is Zeus plays a big role, or Jupiter, depending on if you're doing Greek or Roman, has multiple stories of people making offerings to him and them becoming wolves. And I'll get a little bit into that later on. But the one that I find interesting too is the third one, the warrior werewolf. And those are humans who can willingly shapeshift into a wolf in order to conquer their enemies in battle. And we see this a lot in fantasy stories, video games, or, you know, anybody who's ever played, say, the druid in Diablo 4, or hello, that's nerd alert over here. I just beat that game as a druid and got to shapeshift into a werewolf all the time. And, nice. You know, but the warrior is most commonly associated with stories of ancient Nordic fighters called berserkers. And if anybody's ever said the word berserk or thought of the word berserker, that's where this comes from. They made themselves resemble predatory animals in battle, and they put on the skins of wolves and bears and wild boars in the hopes of taking on that animal's characteristics. And then they would fight like those animals, extremely crazed, violent, howling and roaring, etc. And we see the term berserker used a lot in both gaming as well as true crime culture when referencing, say, serial killers who use a particularly zealous form of violence, like Ted Bundy at Chi Omega. And so that word, you know, that gets kind of tossed casually around these days has a very intense origin that is associated with sort of the merging of man and animal. And I found it interesting, Jason, that you mentioned in Trick or Treat about the female werewolf. That is such a contemporary spin on the lore, because so much of it leading up to, I would say probably the late 20 or early to mid 20th century involved just, it was mostly a male affliction.
Well, this is going to come as a shock to you for a guy who hosts a podcast with the word silver linings in it. But my favorite werewolf stories are the ones like the one in Trick or Treat.
Yeah.
The idea that women could be protected. They can protect themselves. Yes. They don't need help to be protected. They're not always going to be victims. Or even like in The Order in Netflix, where actually the Order of St. Christopher, the good guys are the werewolves and the bad ones are the ones that look like the rest of us.
Oh, interesting.
And I there's something to me that's so powerful about the idea across, you know, shapeshifters, superheroes, villains, of the idea that these things that we've demonized, whether it's witches mm-hmm. or werewolves or it's zombies, these things that we've demonized, there could be a whole nother story.
Yes.
I don't know if you've ever read Anne Rice's Memnock the Devil.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But, you know, like this alternative story to what the devil really was, and he was just really trying to help out, mm-hmm. you know, with God, who is on this trip, but he's actually trying to help out humankind. And I like that alternative version of things. Mm-hmm. There's this great X-Files episode with zombies. They do the zombie episode. And Mulder, Fox Mulder, who's like the lead agent with his partner, Dana Scully, well, they're both lead agents on the X-Files, which, you know, investigates paranormal things. But at the end of the episode, Mulder says something like, you know, what if the zombies just really want to party and dance afterwards? And in the last scene, after they walk away and the doors close, all the zombies wake back up and they start holding this great party and dance. And I think being able to look at these things that we consider, you know, horror, really is outlets for something that's very healthy in us.
Yes.
That's our shadow. It's something we suppress and or long for. And I think that's a very powerful interpretation. But I completely agree with you on your three categories of werewolves. And, you know, there's a similar sort of category system within the broader array of shape-shifting. But what we're seeing right now, I think, is an evolution in our thinking about some of these things, right?
We've had to. So much of the 20th century's pop culture was dominated by white male voices. And it had that same effect of, you know, creating these same dichotomies. And for instance, werewolves being traditionally male, that was often made the case because a lot of storytellers eventually found out that they just preferred to have women in the sort of damsel role and the victim role and the endangered role as sort of the prey for the werewolf. And now, you know, we have all this intersectionality happening in our storytelling, in our way of looking at the world and understanding that multiple personalities, multiple populations are now learning that we are living along, we have to live alongside each other, but we also have a lot in common as humans. And there is a mm-hmm. shared human experience. And it isn't just being told from one point of view anymore. And I think that's absolutely beautiful that you mentioned that, because I think it shows a hunger to break from these traditions that actually have been rooted in so much oppression.
Yep.
And I love seeing the sort of liberation of our monsters from those chains and meant to explore human connectedness and harmony. And, you know, that doesn't mean make your vampires and werewolves and zombies all good guys. It just means that it isn't just about team A against team B.
Well, and also some of it is admitting that maybe some of your vampires and your werewolves and your other shapeshifters are actually good guys, and some of the people who look like us mm-hmm. are not good guys. And I think, you know, to your point about sort of like the white male dominated view, if you go back into history like you were talking about and you look at something, and you made that point about, you know, werewolves and wolves connect us to nature. Well, one of the things that's also mm-hmm. true about humans and wolves that they share in common that you don't always see in the animal kingdom is their willingness to sacrifice themselves for others. So when you go into some of the shape-shifting in the First Nations, it's very much about sacrificing to protect mm-hmm. Themselves from others. I think the evolution in the sort of European view of it, this idea that I'm out of control and I'm not an animal, has a lot to do with the way that European culture developed around needing to control things, needing to be in charge.
Yes.
Which wasn't necessarily true in a lot of other cultures. I'd throw in Norse culture, I'd throw in First Nation culture, where you see some of these same kinds of myths and folklore. It plays a very different mm-hmm. role. And it's neat to see that we're embracing a little bit of that and creating something new.
Yes. I loved looking back at the early origins. I mentioned the Epic of Gilgamesh, and hopping a little further ahead into, you know, ancient Greece, and we're talking about, say, Pliny the Elder, who was a famed Greek historian, perhaps best known for his death in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in Pompeii, an event I would love to cover on this show at some point. And he tells several stories of lycanthropy in many of his histories. He wrote the Naturalis Historia, which was a book that associated cannibalism with wolf-like creatures. And then you hop over into 8 CE to Ovid and Metamorphoses, telling the story about the god Zeus and a king named Lycaon, who was practicing cannibalism in his sacrifices to Zeus. And so Zeus decides he's going to go down and investigate. But Lycaon, the king, refused to believe that Zeus was who he said he was. He was taking on a human form. And so he offers him up some of this human flesh, upon which Zeus became disgusted by the offering, and he destroyed Lycaon's house in a rage. And Lycaon then fled into the fields in terror and anger and began slaughtering his own flock in a fury. Mm. And from there, the transformation into a wolf-like creature begins, thus establishing the etymological roots of lycanthropy, which is also related to lykos in Greek, meaning wolf, and anthropos, man. Lycanthrope, wolfman, or lycanthropy, wolfman syndrome. And that's just one of the words, right? Because werewolf comes from possibly, it's a little muddled, possibly the old German or the Nordic language. And that's also just basically comes down to, again, wolfman. But it's interesting because Greek and Roman histories, like there's so many of them that show that men have been transformed into wolves during sacrifices to Zeus since that story I just told. But there is that caveat that if they abstain from tasting human flesh while being wolves, that they could be restored to human form 9 years later. But if they don't abstain, they remain wolves forever. So this is that cursed wolf thing that I was talking about earlier, where that's the earliest example of that. And I find it interesting too that, Pliny the Elder tells all these other stories where he mentions in Arcadia. Arcadia was the name of sort of the untouched wilderness, the beautiful, unspoiled land, sort of like the Garden of Eden, as maybe we think of it in our culture. And in that, in Arcadia, once a year, a man would be chosen by lot from a certain clan. And then that chosen man would be escorted into a marsh area where he would hang his clothes up and then swim across the marsh and transform into a wolf. And he would join a wolf pack for 9 years. I don't know the significance of the 9 years. I didn't dig that deep, but I'm now suddenly very curious about that. And he would say that if during these 9 years he refrained from tasting human flesh, then he would return to the same marsh, recover his previous human form, and then he would gain 9 years in his life. So you're sort of making these deals where you're like trading something, like giving up a piece of your humanity in exchange for immortality, or a little bit more life. And that follows throughout so much of the lore and the literature, this Faustian deal, as it's often referred to, you know, make a deal.
Yeah, and if you think about the way that we view cannibalism, a lot of our views around cannibalism, you know, cannibalism is something that we as humans don't really understand. And we don't really get where it comes from. We have a hard time wrapping our heads around it. So we built a lot of myths around it. And one of those myths is that, you know, cannibals eat human flesh to live longer and to have power,
yeah,
and all these different things. And I don't think it's a coincidence, this concept of cannibalism and werewolves came together. You were making the point before that wolves and humans are a lot alike. And mm-hmm. we were talking about that idea of this fear. Well, that fear of our animalistic nature, you know, we use words like reptilian brain and other things like that. It's really a fear of ourselves, I think. It's a deeper rooted fear of what we might be cursed with, what we might do to survive or thrive or live longer. And you can see that thread between cannibalism and werewolves throughout history. A lot of folks don't know. I think it was in the 14th and 15th century in Switzerland, literally there were cannibal werewolf trials, just like the Salem witch trials.
Yes. Yes, we were going to talk about that. You're absolutely right. And I did not know. Do you remember when Brett and Alice covered the Salem witch trials
mm-hmm.
and they talked about the Malleus Maleficarum oh, yeah. and all that? That's the sort of legal and theological text that they used back during those witch trials by the Inquisition and everything during the Middle Ages in Europe to say, this is how we torture people, this is how we execute people, to get them to admit that they are witches or werewolves or whatnot. I had no idea, Jason, that there were werewolves mixed mm-hmm. in with the witchcraft. I had that hole in my knowledge and I couldn't believe it. It clicked into place today. And I said, well, of course, that's, you know, of course there would be those charges, because do you know the thing that happened in the Middle Ages that brought that sensibility from this sort of primal nature, human, you know, bonding with the wild and the fear of that primal, you know, instinct that, you know, wolves say exhibit, used to be a very just a deeply carnal human thing. And then we saw the rise of, and this is just a historical note here, not a value judgment, we saw the rise of Christianity in the Middle Ages through this period. And with that came these sort of sets of prescribed behaviors that we needed to put around everything. And everything that was Greek or Roman or, you know, Nordic or whatnot was placed into this category of paganism. And then now we have this new system and we have the church that is setting these new rules and examples. And so it used to be considered heretical that we would even consider that a man could turn into a wolf. You know, that was the providence of God. Only God could make that change. And so we don't even recognize that it's even capable for a man to turn into a wolf. That is heresy. However, later on, it became heresy to deny that this was possible, because we had to find the werewolves. We had to find the witches and persecute yes. them. So,
well, and that's, you know, to your point about sort of like the, you know, the Christian transformation in general, I think you're really striking on what I would view is kind of a key point, like that providence of God, that God's providence to do X, Y, or Z, or do these things, mm-hmm. right? That we as humans need to change. We have to change. To survive, to grow, we have to change. We also fear change.
Yes.
And people in authority fear that change in us. And in animals, for example, like the word metamorphosis, period, is really, it's truly just about transformation. You know, it's a biological process. Animals sort of go from birth to hatching and changing. And when you see a lot of animals take something like a butterfly that goes from a worm to a butterfly, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially what looks like a worm to a larva to a butterfly. That is a dramatic change. And that's the kind of change or transformation I think humans are very, very afraid of.
Yes.
Individually. But I think more broadly in society, because it goes back to that point about control, right? That ultimately, if you do transform, I hate to bring this back because I sometimes view, and I'm not poking at Christianity in general, but institutions right. in general, are often threatened by the idea that people will have dramatic transformations. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to hunt those things. We got to bring them down. It brings me back to this story in high school. I'll never forget with this, like one of my best friends, her name was Lynn. Lynn, if you're out there, you are one of my best friends. And she went off to the military. And after we went to school, which was totally a surprise to everybody that she would have gone into the military. She was also going to college at the same time, but she went off to, did the ROTC thing and then eventually went to the military. And I remember she came out of boot camp like a year later and I was like, who is this trim fit person that could kick my butt? Mm-hmm. And she seemed so much more confident because she had always been shy. And those were all good things, but there's also something scary to me about that. And mm-hmm. I'm willing to admit it because I felt the dynamic changed and I was a little bit scared, right?
Right.
Because our whole dynamic of me being the one that was helpful, me being the one that was kind of more protective was eliminated. And it was frightening to me to see that kind of transformation. And I've always thought about that when it comes to characters that really shift. Mm-hmm. We symbolize that idea of transformation as sort of a dual nature of humanity, right? And that this idea that there's this beast out there which represents the struggle between, you know, like the civilized, rational side and our instinctual side. There's some truth to that, but I think some of it is really about just our fear that things are going to change and there's going to be something scary outside the door.
Yes.
And that scary thing may be just that my wife got a job.
Right.
Right. It may not be all that big, but to some guys, their wives getting a job and being able to like live on their own potentially is as scary as a werewolf.
I think you're so right. These monsters that we create, that we use as vehicles for storytelling, you know, we tend to think nowadays, especially because I think we're all a little jaded. How many zombie movies are there? How many vampire things are there? How many werewolf things are there? And we start to feel like we're just being fed the same thing and it doesn't have that depth. But when you step back from it and you realize that this is a symbol tapping into something, we are trying to explain the chaos of our world through these creatures and try to understand it in some way. And what I found so fascinating when I dove back into this was back, say, during the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, you know, as we're going through, you know, all these inquisitions, as we're going through these witch hunts, and we are putting people on trial for suspected witchcraft and cannibalism and werewolf behavior. I found it really interesting that even during the Black Death of the 1400s, the plagues of the Middle Ages, the bubonic plagues, all that, we were also sort of naming groups that we felt were to blame for this horrible change. Because you talk about fear of change, and when change happens and we don't like it, we have to point the finger at somebody and say, you did this. And of course, during the Black Death, we saw a huge rise in anti-Semitism. We saw a huge rise in all sorts of marginalized populations being blamed for
when
that.
When in reality, they just needed more cats.
And you know that, right? Exactly. Like, they exactly. Needed,
I mean, the Polish had cats and the Black Death barely hit them. So,
you know, it is so true. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because the plague actually caused an even bigger rise in the wolf populations because there were fewer people. For people who don't know, back in the end of the 14th century, upwards of 75% of the global population had died. And I don't mean all at once. I just mean over that 100-year period, we're talking parts of Europe that were almost completely wiped out by this. And so that's how decimated the human race was by the end of the 14th century. It was, by and large, the worst time to ever be alive. Not only that, we had volcanic eruption that had caused a mini ice age. And so people were dying of famine. And then you have these wolf populations exploding everywhere and killing what little livestock people had. And that's another thing I wanted to bring up that I find so interesting about how our attitudes around wolves changed. So prior to the rise of human agriculture and a livestock society, we were hunter-gatherers. And when we were hunter-gatherers, we were more one with the wolf. We were more harmonious with the wolf. You talk about, Jason, the indigenous cultures, First Americas cultures, and their lore around the wolf being a little more of a cooperative and harmonious thing. In Europe, as the wolves were attacking our sheep, literally creating that metaphor that we all love to use to this day, we maligned the wolf. The wolf became the enemy of us. It was decimating our economy because the sheep was the lifeblood. And so if the sheep were being killed, in addition to all this disease and warfare and mayhem that are killing people left and right, we have these damn wolves. And so they became the enemy. And then what happened after that time period, around the 1600s, Europeans start coming over to the Americas. We see a huge clash of culture and lore. And the Americas were filled with wolves, just like over in Europe. And so that afforded us the opportunity to use that, their cultural fear of the wolf, and to see that the natives had embraced the wolf, and it sort of fueled that fire that led to the subjugation of the indigenous people. It largely, that disagreement over the wolf is incredible. That one little thing, it almost makes me wonder, like, if we'd ever agreed on the wolf culturally.
Well, think about Aesop's fable and the wolf and the shepherd, right? You know, the wolf prowling around the flock of sheep for a long time, you know, the shepherd worrying, trying to prevent the wolf from carrying off a lamb. And, you know, like, finally, the shepherd sees the wolf, mm-hmm. right? To a Garden of Eden moment, and forgets about how wicked the wolf is. And then ultimately, you know, a wolf is going to wolf, and he takes the lamb away. But I think it's a part of a broader history that we use things like the wolf or whatever to scare people. Like, I think of in African American culture, you know, still down, if you go to where my dad's family is from, you know, you've got shifting spirits that can become animals like cats or owls, and yeah. stories of stuff like that that were used to spy on African-American families or cause harm. Where did that come from? That came from slaveholders
yes.
who were utilizing that. And I think something very, very similar happened in Europe around things like wolves. Mm-hmm. Not only is it a real, genuine fear that exists, but then that fear is leveraged for control. And that's where I think when we get to our buddy Elizabeth Bathory, I think we get a great example of that. Mm-hmm. And it's this, you know, yet another witch hunt, right? These yes. legitimate fears that exist get turned into witch hunts or tools to manipulate people. And that's one thing I'll say, Allison, that's really cool about monsters in general, mm-hmm. is that our use of monsters over the last hundreds or so years has flipped the script on so many of these things that were used to articulate supernatural punishment or
yes.
to suggest someone was damned or going away. Now they're in my video games.
Yes, so, yes, right? Absolutely. I've loved sort of delving into all of this lore this month, just specifically for that reason, because now when I, you know, pick up a video game and the zombie video game, I might reflect back on so many of the things that zombies have represented in our culture and in cultures throughout the world. And then also with the werewolf, I'm hailing back to the vintage of most vintage werewolf video games, Altered Beast. And as a kid, it was one of my favorites growing up. But I think about how, you know, we've used the werewolf to really try to dig down into parts of human nature that we just do not quite understand, and how that has morphed with our growing understanding of
the world. I would put a flip on that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that it's parts of human nature that we don't understand. We understand it. We just don't want to face the reality.
Yes, yes.
You know, I heard you and Brett talking in the last episode, and you were talking about the zombie apocalypse, and, you know, would Brett, what was the question? It was, would Brett practice cannibalism in a survival situation?
Yeah.
Like, Brett is a very honest and open guy, and he's willing to admit reality, but that is a reality most people don't want to admit.
Right.
At the end of the day, we would hunt like a pack of wolves.
We would. We would. And it would not take much, I don't think, to make us cast aside the artifice that we've constructed around ourselves, you know, this proper...
A second Trump presidency.
Yeah. You know what? I am leaving that in there. I love that you said that. Thank you, sir. Thank you for putting voice to my own thoughts. I appreciate that. You know, I loved watching, too, the way the werewolf in the Middle Ages sort of, you know, the what we established during the Middle Ages set the scene for so much of the things that we sort of take for granted now. And I kind of want to bring in a true crime element now, because I found this absolutely fascinating during my research. So this was all during the sort of the werewolf trials that were going on that peaked in the late 17th century. So we're starting to wind this down. This is about the time when I think a lot of the people in power were like, we need to knock this off. And there was a man, a German man named Peter Strube, and he was an accused killer who was believed to take on the shape of a werewolf in order to kill his victims without being caught. And here's the interesting thing about how they came around to believing this. Hunters initially thought they were tracking a wolf who'd been slaughtering, you know, men, women, and children and livestock around the community. And so they assumed it was an animal. And so when they were tracking this wolf, they lost track of it, but they found Peter, who was a farmer, wandering around those same woods. And for whatever reason, they just decided to assume that Peter had just changed back into his human form, that he was the wolf. Okay. So they put him...
I feel bad for Peter.
Peter was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, it sounds like. But who knows, right? Because... Well, and I'll just finish the story here. He was put through brutal torture, of course, whereupon he admitted under that torture to killing 14 children, 2 pregnant women, as well as his own son. He also admitted...
Well, then, if he admitted it...
And he also admitted to cannibalism and having an affair with a quote-unquote she-devil. His daughter and that mistress were also found guilty as accessories, and they were all executed on October 31st, 1589.
Wow.
Yeah. And after they dismembered and burned his body, they kept his head and mounted it on a pike above a statue of a wolf. And that story became a huge sensation in Great Britain and other places because there was a book written about it. And it sort of reinvigorated interest in werewolves after people had been sort of taking a breather. And what we now know, historians looking back at this, show that these chronicles are actually people coming to grips with the existence of serial killers. Rather than anything supernatural, they just didn't have the vocabulary. And in fact, we didn't get the vocabulary or the understanding of serial killers until the mid-20th century, really. But we like to think that in the 20th century that the serial killer was this new thing that we had discovered, when in fact, it's very likely they've always been among us. We just didn't know what they were or what it was, or we were attributing it to supernatural elements. And so, again, the werewolf tied into serial killers.
It makes perfect sense because it ties back to that same idea of us needing to use these characters, use these spirits, use these different things, whether it's the, you know, the people in the North and Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. or it's any of these different elements to try and explain either parts of ourselves or parts of the world that we have a hard time wrapping our heads around. I think there is a innate human need to understand the world around us. And when we can't understand the world around us, and there will always be parts that we can't understand, we have this tendency, I think, to create stories. Sometimes, you know, stories can be powerful. They can be good. They can heal people. They can help people. They can also be dangerous. You know, we see that in the Holocaust. We see that in the Elders of Zion. We see that in all sorts of examples throughout time. And I think we create these stories sometimes to, you know, you create the boogeyman to scare kids into going to sleep. You create all sorts of different things, you know. And in African-American culture, there's there's the boo hag, which is from the Gullah American folklore, and it, you know, sucks your breath or energy when people are asleep. Well, you know, it was a way to get to the slaves to go to sleep. And we create these stories, and they can either be very good and powerful, or they can be very harmful. So this idea that you're getting at, Allison, that we can go back and take a look at these stories, and we can learn not just, you know, like to the point about serial killers, we can learn a lot about ourselves and what we do when we try to fill the unknown, when we try to write the fan fiction of the unknown.
Ooh, I like that line, writing the fan fiction of the unknown. That's great. I think you're so right. And I think what we find and what I have found time and time again, as I delve into history to learn a little something else about a person or an event that happened, you know, centuries ago, is the fact that we haven't changed a whole lot as a species. There is a lot that we think, you know, we see some brutalities today and we see some horrible things happening today. And we think this is the product of a new generation, that it wasn't like this before, that the people that came before us were always better than we are now, or had a deeper understanding of something that we've now lost. And there could be a bit of that, you know, because we do shed things as we go along and we have to relearn things. But, you know, as far as human nature is concerned, you know, this idea that now we're just newly selfish or newly binary or newly, you know, backwards in our thinking in some way, it's more like the further back you look, the more you see, no, I think they were trying to make the same discoveries then that we're trying to now. And maybe we've gained more understanding about certain things. But this leads me to my next question. And I'm going to lead up to that because this is all going to tie in, I promise. So
far, so good.
And thank you. So in the 18th century and beyond, you know, we've gotten through the Middle Ages. And again, I'm very much Cliff's noting this whole situation here because we don't have 5 hours. But by the late 18th century and after that, both the idea of a werewolf as both magical transformation and a mental illness in which one believes they've been transformed into an animal, that's called lycomania and is an actual disorder recognized to this day, we started thinking more scientifically. We're talking about the birth of the industrial age. We are probably more wizards at this point in history than we've ever been since, in many ways. We are discovering electricity. We are inventing the telegram, the telephone. We are inventing, you know, horrifying chemicals to use in warfare. We are inventing bombs. We're inventing early versions of Wi-Fi, thanks to Hedy Lamarr, because of torpedoes and wireless transmissions. You know, we're learning so many magical, amazing things. The world has become this thing that we've like tapped into some deep understanding. And with that comes this desire to understand what made people think werewolves were an actual thing, like there was a supernatural werewolf. And so came these sort of medical explanations. We have, again, we mentioned porphyria in the vampire episode. It's going to get another mention here. It's a disease. that causes a lot of symptoms that resemble what we think of as vampirism or werewolf or lycanthropy. We have sensitivity to sunlight, hyperpigmentation, red or reddish brown teeth. You know, all these sort of like irrational behaviors and things like that. We would blame yet again ergot poisoning. That's that fungus that makes everybody go crazy, that has been blamed for everything from the dancing plagues of, you know, the 1500s to, you know, the Salem witch trials, all of which is wrong. But we keep bringing up ergot as a means to try to understand, you know, or to blame some substance or some object as the cause for this unbridled homicidal lust that human beings have exhibited over our, you know, entire history. But yet again, you know, that doesn't hold up. The closer you look at a theory like that, the more you find that it's mostly empty. And so others have pointed out things like hypertrichosis, which is, you might have seen pictures of people like this where their entire body is covered in hair, you know, their face and everything. It is a very, very rare hereditary condition that causes that kind of excessive hair growth. But that's also not possible because it's such a rare disease that people back then wouldn't have seen it on a large enough scale to cause this sort of like cultural belief in werewolves. And then rabies, that's another one that's been kind of pulled out as a possible belief. And so I just want to throw this out there as we look at all these things like medical diagnoses to explain these wild behaviors of our ancestors and these crazy beliefs that they had. I believe it's important to understand that the monsters we create, we shouldn't be trying so hard to explain them away with rational explanations like this is a disease or they ate a fungus that made them go crazy. Because I think it's important to maintain and understand that the role of human imagination in the tales we weave is so important.
Oh, I think that's a great, great, great point. You made me think of like as a child, and you know, everyone denies it now, but like that as a child, when you imagine that you're the bird or an insect or whatever it is, there's something about the fantasy that leads to so much innovation.
Yeah. That human creativity, that human spark to sort of come up with these stories, these legends is kind of it's a beautiful thing. And on the same token, though, I guess it is also kind of important to sort of throttle it a little bit because you have to create an anchor for that imagination just so that we don't find ourselves, say, accusing people with epilepsy of being demonically possessed, you know? So there is a line there of where we can say, oh, we don't have to be afraid of this thing anymore because now we know what's causing it.
But I can tell you something about the science behind those things. That's a great example with epilepsy and demonic possession. But part of the reason why we have so much historical, before we knew what epilepsy was, we have so much historical information about it is because people would write tons of stuff down about these demonic possessions.
Yeah.
And so while we may not necessarily want to make it something negative, let's say, but there's a value in creating stories around these things that we don't understand.
Yes.
You know, they don't have to be malevolent, but that someday in the future, as things progress, someone is going to figure out something related to this that moves the world forward. And if those stories aren't told, there isn't the same opportunity to grow.
That is so true. I've been kind of making these statements a little bit on the internet about the sort of the death of the humanities and, you know, leading to the sort of a death of humanity if we're not careful. Because now that we have sort of streamlined a lot of education in this country, especially toward STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, you know, education, learning these things so that we can go out and get a job one day and become, you know, computer engineers and all these other, you know, lofty things that obviously is very much in demand, but we're not leaving enough room for reading about these stories and these human experiences and things like understanding what fascism looks like, understanding our histories so that we don't repeat them. And, you know, we're leaving a lot of that education in the dust in favor of the sort of hardline understandings of, you know, the way the world works. We're breaking it down into all these algorithms.
ChatGPT is an amazing metaphor for this.
Yes.
Let me just throw this out. So you've got this giant language model that sucks in all this data from the internet, from books that have been written, and all of this knowledge, and it produces answers for us. And everyone talks about how artificial intelligence like ChatGPT is going to replace writers. It's going to replace all sorts of things like that. Well, what happens when there are not people creating original knowledge? Right. It starts to break. And people call this the knowledge age because I'm so on board with this. But I actually think there's a knowledge desert right now because we're so focused on the technical, practical movement of science.
Right.
Right. And not the deeper, richer things that it's actually based on.
Yes. Right. Yes.
I just don't think we would be able, you know, we're building upon something and advancing upon something, but we're making the focus so narrow on the sciences and mathematics and engineering that we're weakening the foundation that all of those things are built on. You know the old joke, right? That sociologist standing somewhere and the psychologist says that, you know, sociology is just applied psychology. And then there's a biologist and the biologist says, you know, psychology is just applied biology. And then there's a, you know, a chemist who says, well, biology is just applied chemistry, and a physicist who says that, well, you know, like chemistry is just applied physics, and finally a mathematician who says it's all math. But the reality is it's all the knowledge that we have connected, collected, and passed on.
Yeah.
None of those things, from sociology to calculus, right, exactly, exist without literature and art. And those things are the actual foundation to all of those things. And, you know, what I would tell you scientists out there who are poo-pooing my point is, who's going to tell your story? Mm-hmm. Who's going to pass your information on? Who's going to tell the lessons, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so.
I want people to go to college, if they're going to college, to remember to take some literature and philosophy and psychology and history, for the love of God. You know, people complain about these prerequisites a lot of times in education. And often these are the foundational things that you need. And it worries me right now. We're looking at a world that is in some intense conflict right now, to put it very mildly. Yeah. You know, what's happening in the Middle East right now, for instance, a massive conflagration that's been building for 70 plus years and has been having fires off and on throughout all of that. But what we're seeing is new people coming into the understanding, or trying to come into the understanding of what is happening right now with this conflict, say in Israel and Palestine. And they lack completely that historical context of both sides. And you want to ask them, do you know why Israel was established? Do you know what the history of Palestine is in this conflict between the two? Do you even have that basic foundation of understanding? And they often do not seem to have that knowledge. So I just think we're living in that sort of proof that, you know, we are forgetting a lot of these stories. And I know that this is a bit of a tangent we got off on, but I feel like it applies to why what we're talking about here, just about these sort of what we think of like, oh, Jesus, it's just Teen Wolf. Well, you just stop being so serious about it. And it's like, no, because that's just a fun way of looking at something that has a lot more implications attached to it. And I want to go deeper every single time and like find that sort of bedrock.
Once you've stopped telling stories and passing on stories, we have nothing and we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes over and over again.
The werewolf is so about, I think, that passing of stories, that folklore that, you know, our European ancestors have intermingled it with a lot of fear and insecurity. But then we have the, you know, if we look at the Native American view and see something a lot, this more harmonious protective thing, protective yeah thing. And we can sort of bridge these things together because absolutely there are anxieties and insecurities these cultures is like in Native culture as well that they express in other ways. And so it's like these are all human emotions we're dealing with here. And so I think it's fun to pick that apart.
Can I give us a pat on the back for progress though?
Oh, absolutely.
Because, yeah, you know, to many of the points that you're making, I think part of this transformation around monsters, werewolves, shapeshifters in general really has to do, to some extent, how we have gained a better understanding of things like mental health conditions mm-hmm and other topics and how we become more transparent in society about risks on things like climate change or, you know, forests or whatever it is, right?
Right.
That by dropping those stigmas and having those conversations, we can now have a John, Arya, and Bran Stark that where their dire wolves give them their strength
yes
and transform them. We can have those dancing zombies and the X-Men who are like your kids who may have been outcasts or outside of the popular club. Mm-hmm. And you can have people like Rogue from the X-Men who is able to take on people's qualities and characteristics, who's like a good guy, and Lori from Trick or Treat, who's able to protect herself.
Yes.
That we're able to now say that like some of our differences can be powerful
yeah
and can be good. And I'm not always an optimist, but I will give us some points for what the transformation of the way that we look at some of these monsters says about our willingness to admit that some of the things that we think are monsters aren't really.
I think that's a beautiful insight to make. I also want to mention, too, that I find it really interesting as we're talking about, you know, the use of werewolves in our stories and in our own personal mythologies and our own cultures is, you know, we even see life imitating art because, you know, back in after World War One, there were groups of German soldiers who refused to disband afterward. And they joined together calling themselves Werwolf, you know, Werwolf. And this group would become the elite Nazi recruiting force in World War II. And they would borrow from old werewolf myths to make their propaganda. And Hitler himself also fancied himself as something of a werewolf. So that mythology.
Yeah, he had the wolf's lair.
Yes.
His base. Right?
And so you can often see too, where if you are aware of this kind of, all these sort of cultural threads that run through all these stories, then it gives you a lesson about, you know, even the evils of people and trying to, you know, be on the lookout for a certain symbology. As of right now, you know, I mean, you're fully immersed in the Delphi case with all this Odinist stuff being tossed around and whatnot.
Oh, don't get me started.
I was gonna
You want a real tangent.
No kidding. I did find myself thinking about that a little bit as I was putting this outline together and I was seeing all these sort of Nordic things and whatnot. I'm like, oh, here we go.
I have spent more time defending heathens over the last 2 weeks than I ever would have thought in my entire lifetime.
Oh my God. Well, thank you, because I consider myself one in a casual basis.
Good. Well, I got your back, buddy.
I appreciate it. So I want to ask you then, as we point our way toward our conclusion here, but we talked about Teen Wolf and, you know, sort of our first werewolf experience, but what about some of the more modern looks at it? You know, like, for instance, I have to bring up Harry Potter. It's controversial now. I don't talk a lot about Harry Potter these days, but the Professor Lupin character in that story, I think that's a character that will resonate with a lot of our younger, up to more millennial audience members, as an interesting use of sort of the werewolf who is sort of a societal outcast, who is diseased in some way and trying to hide it, that sort of disheveled way. A lot of people say that he was sort of like a way to represent the HIV AIDS crisis, because, you know, he would have this this taboo sort of disease that he had to kind of like pretend he didn't have. A lot of people mention also Twilight in the same breath, because it's one of the more famous examples of modern age. Although that story misappropriates a lot of Native American lore, some would definitely say.
Yeah.
But it is like, I think younger people, when they think of werewolves, they're probably thinking immediately of Professor Lupin or Jacob from Twilight. But we also have like Eddie Munster, you know, Dark Shadows. Mm. And then we have like the year of 1981, man. I don't know what happened in 1981, but
The Howling?
Yeah, The Howling and American Werewolf in London. You know, right? Those two movies. Yes. I wonder what it was about that year.
Well, the 1980s were, in my mind, like a heyday for horror. I do not know what was happening. Something happened in the 1990s where it all got broke, maybe too much peace and prosperity. But the 1980s were quite a decade for, you know, because you also had, you had Teen Wolf with Michael J. Fox. You had like The Howling then. Mm-hmm. The series also, in addition to the movie.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about the series. Yeah.
It was, and like you said, American, you know, Werewolf in London, which is like a great horror comedy. I mean, it was groundbreaking in terms of its special effects too. And all that dark humor was super powerful.
It was really cool too, to see sort of how a lot of those things were picked up after, you know, they were laid down by, you mentioned the Wolfman, and then we have the Werewolf of London, the original one, because we talked about the American Werewolf in London, which was more like a satire spoof comedy with sort of combined Werewolf of London with an American in Paris kind of dynamic. But the Werewolf of London was really the first on-screen depiction of a bite transferring the sort of quote unquote disease of werewolf into somebody. And what's interesting in that is that East Asia was the source of the curse this time. And I think it being that this was in the 1930s, that, you know, we start to see sort of the geopolitical situations of the time sort of being again represented. But, you know, it also showed sort of a representation of things like repressed homosexuality, a warning against the advancement of science, a fear of disease, etc. And that year, again, was huge because it came out at the same time as Bela Lugosi's Mark of the Vampire and Boris Karloff's The Bride of Frankenstein. The movies were lit that year, which I found so cool. But Universal Studios, who funded all these movies, The Werewolf of London didn't stick out. It was kind of a flop. It couldn't stand up to the vampire and the Frankenstein. And so Universal came back a few years later in 1941 and gave us the Wolfman, which, right, you know, right, we were all talking about. And, you know, that one, again, showed a lot of the similarities of sort of reflecting the anxieties of the time.
And we got 40 years of werewolf movies just like it.
Oh, yeah. So that's the problem, you know, that is like, oh, this hit once, we're going to just do it over and over and over again.
For everyone who thinks like movie theaters are just repeating the same thing over and over again, this is not new.
No. Remakes of remakes were already happening in the silent movie era.
Right.
So, you know, when people say, oh, today nothing's original. Now I will say, yeah, we have a lot of sequels now, but so many of the movies that we have that we take for granted today were made first in the golden age and the silent era. I also found too, going back and looking at some of these old movies was very similar to looking at the old vampire movies or the old zombie movies, and seeing how a lot of times they were in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, they were using these movies to deal with sort of the other, You know, that is kind of what the zombie represented in early zombie movies, sort of this fear of people coming into our country. There's always a bit of xenophobia running through all this.
You know what the thread that runs through a lot of these things are? It's this concept, and I think we need to get over ourselves when it comes to this. It's this concept that things like werewolves, zombies, etc., represent some kind of moral decay, right?
Right.
It's like our struggle to control our wild or the evil inside of us, you know, and there's definitely this notion there of this struggle between good and evil in us. But this idea that the other is something that can't control its raw emotions, whether they're like violent, destructive, or sexual, is something that I think this is what I love about millennials, the younger millennials. I love about Gen Y. They are throwing that out the window and they're embracing the other and are no longer making other equal moral decay.
Yes. Yeah. I love that so much. And it's actually, it's forced me as a storyteller to think outside the box in terms of how I'm presenting characters and why I think I love moral ambiguity a lot in my characters and in the stories that I tell, or finding ways to make the unsympathetic sympathetic. Because I feel that saying that we don't have some means to relate to bad or evil things is kind of a form of hypocrisy. And knowing that we have the potential for good or evil as a species, and not going, oh, you're born evil or you're born good or whatnot. And I love, as a psychology nerd, the study of the work of Philip Zimbardo, the psychologist who was behind the Stanford Prison Experiment, which was an infamous study back in the 1970s that went horribly awry. But he has, you know, a lot of his later work talks about how we are equally capable of being hero and villain in the same lifetime, in the same instance, almost
in the same breath. We're constantly making trade-offs, and I think, to your point, Allison, we have to let this idea of we're either good people or bad people go, because you know, you know, from my personal story, I'm willing to bet most people who know me think I'm a good person. A lot of people who don't know me think I'm a bad person.
Right.
And so, you know, I had this situation today. You'll love this. So I gave a $250 donation to someone on GoFundMe. And then all of a sudden on Twitter, there's screenshots of my donation up there and then attacks on me. And they're saying I'm trying to get attention or something like that.
I
privately did it. There will always be people who view me as a bad guy.
Yeah.
Who may have done something good, but he did it for a real bad reason. And there are people who view me as a good person who made some bad mistakes. And I think the vast majority of us are really good people. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why we're not all serial killers. Most of us are good people who just sometimes do bad things, sometimes in the exact same moment. We fall short. And that's okay, because at the end of the day, there's a part of me that's human. There's a part of me that's a werewolf. The thing that I'll ultimately tell you is, the one thing I'm sure of, I'm a shapeshifter, because life is about change. And it's about shifting your shape. And it's about growing and persevering through things. And sometimes good things happen, sometimes bad. But, you know, this idea of transformation to me is just growth. Yeah. That's all it is.
I can't imagine a better sentiment to wrap this up on, Jason. What is it with these people I bring on my show that are just smart and stuff?
Like, oh, please. We sit around talking about how you know everything. How smart you are.
Nah, I'm really good at it. I'm a quick study. I think that is really my my one thing. I am that person who was cramming for the exam 6 hours before the exam.
Up until last minute?
Yeah, you know.
Then I was in the dorm down the hall doing the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel motivated to do anything until I feel that press of a deadline, like on my back and saying, get this done. And my kids are the same way. And I feel like I, you know, I want to apologize to them for that.
It's a lot more maddening in your kids, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I tell you what, nothing is better than having gotten them through education. Just some, you know, once we crossed that little ocean, I felt like, okay, not that adulthood has been much easier for them, you know, as they're getting their feet under them and learning how life works and all that. But it's like, I just love that people who are able to have that insight to realize that we are a multitude of things. And I don't believe that we are our worst mistakes. And I don't believe that we are, we should be defined by our lowest point, because that to me is just shows such a lack of charity. And I have always been a person who will always give someone my trust until they give me a reason to take it back. And if that means that I'm, you know, if I get burned or if I get hurt or if I get proven wrong, so be it. I will not feel bad for acting in good faith. I just will not.
Yeah, it's a great way to operate. Like, I'm willing to bet. I don't know what you like about me. I don't know why you like me. But I'm willing to bet that if you listed three things or even five things that you like about me, they would all tie back to my worst moments. Because that's where I learned.
Wow. I think that would be an interesting sort of exercise for people to think about the things that they like about themselves and how that relates to their worst moments. Because correct. I think you're absolutely right, and why you shouldn't, or why people shouldn't wish to undo a lot of those things, you know. And I love your attitude, and I love the way you share it with the world. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you for having me on. And I can tell you each one of those things is very tied. You know, I would not be as humble as I am. I would not be as compassionate as I am. I don't think I would have even been, not to say I am ridiculously smart, but as smart as I am, if I hadn't been forced by those things to examine the world and examine the world around me. And I always tell people that as hard as what I went through by my own hand, what I went through was, I don't think I would have liked the person I would have become without it. So, yeah. And you know what? The werewolf in me is allowed to now hang out in the living room because he's not that scary.
Are you feeding him some treats every now and then? You got to give him something to chew on, you know.
The cats will if he behaves.
Yes, see? See, and that's what I want to encourage everybody to do is, you know, we look at the history of the werewolf, the more Eurocentric version of the werewolf as this sort of way of that we wrestle with our worst urges. And I say, yes, I say, let's sort of drop the adversarial aspect. And yeah, let's get to know that little pooch living inside us. And, awesome. You know, and yeah, that's what I invite everyone to do. And I'll go ahead and wrap it up here. But I just want to hear from everybody else who listened to this and had some insight. Reach out to me at ddarknesstime@gmail.com. Reach out to me on Twitter. I will, of course, you know, I'm most active on there, but I'm also on Facebook quite a bit. I have the Facebook page for Ding Dong Darkness Time podcast. A lot of listeners will see me kind of traipsing around various true crime circles on Facebook as well. So, you know, feel free to hit me up if you see me in the gallery, the prosecutor's gallery, or in Jason's group for the Silver Linings Handbook. And give Jason's show a listen. Why don't you? I love listening to the discussions. They kind of give me that bit of like NPR feeling, you know, whenever you, the way you do it. Like, and so when I was listening to my episode with you, I was like, man, it kind of started off. I felt like a guest on a real radio show. It was really cool.
Well, I can tell you a lot of people loved you.
Well, thank you. And they're going to love you here too, man. I promise you that. So anyway, that is all I got for now. Tune in next week where we are going to sit down and talk about something a little devilish, a little witchy. And that's all I'm going to say. This episode was produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon, and wouldn't be possible without the amazing contributions of countless friends, family, and supporters. Big shouts also go out to Nathaniel Dixon for all the show art, as well as Spencer Morlock and Ken Dixon for the music. I'll be back with something new next week. In the meantime, you know what to do. Be good, you little ding-dongs.